This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition with Lynn and Shamila. We're moving on to our next story, and it's a big one. I think it's actually dominated a lot of conversation this week, and that is the issue of queue jumping and the worry, in fact, that is held by so many people that it's something that's going to happen. It's something that we are seeing occur in other countries as well. So we are not alone in this, just like with everything else to do with COVID-19. And yeah, that's what we wanted to focus on.
So as we all know, Malaysia kicked off its national immunization program for COVID-19 on the 24th of February. But already we have stories of people claiming that, people have jumped that queue, because there is it is being done in phases. The first phase is, of course, for frontliners who are currently being vaccinated. The second phase will involve high-risk groups and those aged above 60. And everyone else will follow after that. But there is news coming out, even from public officials. So, for instance, Dr. Rafida Abdullah said that she received many messages on queue jumping for the vaccine. And then Minister Khairi Jamaluddin responded that he was actually taking this seriously. He even urged, as we talked about earlier, he's urged whistleblowers to email him anonymously, and that he was going to deal with this very seriously.
So to paint a picture, right, the allegations when it comes to vaccine queue jumping here in the country, when it comes to social media, mostly focus on claims that families and officers of VIPs, politicians, civil servants are receiving the vaccinations. There were allegations that, for example, some of the lists that were being submitted for vaccination simply did not make sense in terms of amount. And the Special Committee on COVID-19 Vaccine Supply Access Guarantee has issued a clear guideline on those who are eligible to receive vaccines in the first phase. The health minister has said fines will be imposed on those who jump the queue. The minister has also gone on to say that there is no evidence of queue jumping and that vaccines have only been administered to frontliners. And the confusion might have occurred as those who had appointments to be vaccinated did not turn up or had arrived late. And so I don't think we want to necessarily cast aspersions. I think what I'm most interested in is why it is that so many people were convinced something like this was happening, and why it's so plausible. Because it's entirely plausible. It is definitely something that I think we can understand. And I think that's part of the larger conversation about vaccine equity and the concerns that people have that the distribution isn't going to be equal, right? And so what needs to be done to A, ensure that it is equal, but also to successfully communicate to everybody that all the T's are crossed, all the I's are dotted, everything is as it should be.
So many things in what you just said are exactly the things that most people have no faith in. The sense that things are going to be transparent, a sense that equity is something that they're concerned about, that when the program is being rolled out, everything will be done as it should be, on the proper schedule, with the right measures in place. One of the things that this pandemic has revealed truly is that a lot of us have such a lack of faith in these things, and that has extended from before. It has really laid bare, I think, a lot of these gaps now, and I think that's part of the problem. I don't know how true the stories of queue jumping are, but the fact that so many people are so willing to believe them, and to the point where officials have had to come out and make multiple statements, I think is very telling about why this is an important thing to address.
Yes, suffice to say, the fact that they are so believable in and of itself is a central concern. Mm. So let us know. I mean, have you heard stories of queue jumping? Is this something that you're worried about? Call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We're crossing over now to health policy specialist, Dr. Kaur Swee King. Swee King, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Lynn and Shamila.
So there have been worries around queue jumping from the very beginning. Why do you think this has been such a primary concern for many?
Well, Lynn and Sharmila, there could be several reasons for why this is such a concern. I guess, firstly, people are worried about whether or not they will get the vaccine when it's their turn to get the vaccine. And any sort of inequality or unfairness, I think, would raise the doubts of people, and they might feel fearful that they will not be protected when it's time for them to be protected. And I think this is a very real fear. The second reason why people are concerned about queue jumping is because of fairness. And I think human beings as a species, we're very sensitive to issues of fairness and justice. And we want to make sure that that the world is fair and orderly, and that we'll be able to get the vaccines as and when it's necessary and appropriate for us to get these vaccines. Perhaps thirdly and finally, people are very angry and upset about double standards in Malaysia, frankly, any other country. So it's not just a Malaysian problem. So people are upset about double standards. We want to make sure that just because you're a politician or a VIP, for example, you should not get the vaccines if you don't deserve it in the first instance. So these are the reasons why people are quite concerned about queue jumping.
Speaking, it may seem like an obvious question, but how does queue jumping impact public health and efforts to contain the pandemic?
It will impact in, say, two broad ways and two very, very specific ways, yeah? The first one is if the right person who needs the vaccine first, meaning those who are vulnerable, like frontliners and senior citizens and those with multiple diseases or those who have immune-compromised states, if these people do not get the vaccines first, then there's a public health threat because we are directly endangering them because we're not providing them protection as early as possible. So the first doses of the vaccines, especially in periods of scarcity, need to go to those who deserve it rather than those who want it or those who think that they need it. So therefore, the first effect on public health is that those who deserve the protection will not be protected, and therefore, you know, will lead to a rise in cases. We have more, say, frontline professionals getting diseases. They could be out of commission, and that's one direct reason why it can impact public health. But the second reason why queue jumping can also affect efforts to contain the pandemic, to your question, Sharmila, is because it is an issue of trust. If citizens in any country, for example, Malaysia, cannot trust that the system will allocate resources and vaccines to them when they deserve it, then we'll lose trust in the public healthcare system. And trust is a precious commodity in any pandemic because we need to trust the government and the government's doing the right decisions, making the right calls in whatever policies that they choose to implement. And because it's such a precious commodity, if we have queue jumping, it would erode trust, which would then therefore erode the effectiveness of the pandemic responses.
So we have seen statements coming out from this, right? Both from the coordinating minister and the health minister. What do you think about the government's communication and messaging when it comes to this matter?
Well, I have two thoughts. The first thought is to say that we welcome the rhetoric that's quite strong by the coordinating minister, Minister Khairy, who has come on BFM and he's spoken about the need for vaccine equity, which is a theme around the world right now. So the statements made by him and several other leaders have been promising and very welcome to reassure the population that there will be no queue jumping. And I think there have been not only the rhetoric, but also matched by some actions. For example, the fine that was announced by the health minister, up to 50,000 ringgit for any queue jumpers and a whistleblowing hotline, so to speak, that Minister Khairy has also encouraged members of the public to report to him if there are any allegations or any suspicions of queue jumping. All these are good steps to take. So that's my first set of thoughts. So rhetoric is one thing. Proposed or promised actions are another. We want to see the enforcement. We want to see that the system actually prevents queue jumping to an effective degree that we don't even have allegations concerning it. So what I mean to say is rhetoric's great and it's welcome. And I think we're all saying the right things. Secondly, we're also matching with proposed and promised actions, which is also very good. We're waiting for the appropriate enforcement, especially with no double standards in the enforcement itself.
So in terms of that, exactly that, the action, right? Is enough being done to potentially curb this issue?
This is always going to be a question where the answer is that some things are being done, but more can be done. And I think the same is similar for other countries as well. Maybe here I'll, and at some point, maybe we'll talk about what other countries have done. It'll be interesting to see, pick one example or rather one basis to compare Malaysia's responses in other countries. In other countries, one important or rather two important differences are, firstly, these things are found and then declared publicly, and that's perhaps in contrast to Malaysia, because we've had, in recent days, some gag orders are being slapped on the colleagues and friends in the Ministry of Health, for example. And this is, I guess, consistent with the civil services general orders, which is fine, we agree. But if there's going to be any internal channels to raise concerns, and which is what the Ministry of Health wants their staff to do, then these internal channels should really work and not just be a rhetorical device again. And the point I'm making is these things are found out in other countries, and I think that that's an important piece of the puzzle for Malaysia. The second piece of the puzzle in Malaysia that we can follow from other countries is what we do after we find this out. So inevitably, we might see one or two cases where even with the best of intentions and the best of systems, we will find that there have been one or two queue jumpers. And I think that's, well, in a sense, I would say reasonably acceptable. What we cannot accept is systemic queue jumping, that it is rampant, it is widespread, and it is systemic. If it's one or two, what we must do then is address them to make sure that they don't recur, that they don't become systemic. This is something that other countries are good at. Not only do they prevent queue jumping, but they also have mechanisms to detect it. And then thirdly and finally, to address it if they do find it.
So let's talk about those other countries, right? What examples are there of queue jumping and how they've worked to contain it?
A broad question for which I won't be able to provide a holistic answer because there's a lot of data points out there. What we can do is, I guess, Google and say things like queue jumping and so on. But a couple of examples come to mind, you know, maybe three examples. The first one was a spin cycle or a soul cycle instructor in New York who claims that she was a teacher and therefore went to the head of the queue. That's one example of queue jumping. What happened to her? I think she received a fine and a lot of social media condemnation. There's a second example of a billionaire in Canada that chartered a plane, flew to Indigenous Canadians, the First Nations, meaning the Native Canadians. He flew to the reservation with his wife and got a vaccine that was supposed to be given to Indigenous Canadians. And I think he is facing at least a fine and possibly jail term as well. But I don't know this for sure, but certainly he was found out. The third example is also from Canada. So I don't know why there's a North American flavor to this. The CEO of the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board, it manages about $400 billion in assets, had to resign. Why? Because he left Canada to go to the United Arab Emirates. He went to Dubai to get two shots of the vaccine. And after getting the first shot, he was found out, he had to resign. So the theme over here is that these people were found out, called out, and suffered consequences as a result.
We do have a little bit of a pivot because we have a question from a listener. Yorak wants to know, well, basically he says he's more concerned about not being able to choose what vaccine he receives. And he says, I'm not comfortable in the slightest about possibly getting dosed with the Sinovac vaccine. Any thoughts on that?
To the person who asked the question, a great question. My first thought is to say, consult your doctor. And I think that's a great place to start. A few other structural thoughts are as follows. Firstly, in Malaysia right now, that we do not have the luxury of choice. We have approved three vaccines, but only Pfizer is available as a stock. The other two vaccines might come in, I don't know, April, May, June. We don't know when the delivery schedule would be. So the point being that in the ideal situation of choice, I'll get to that in a second, that ideal situation might not exist in Malaysia for perhaps the next 3 months, 6 months, maybe even 12 months until such a time where we can actually choose. Few countries in the world are giving choices. Perhaps the only country is Hong Kong that's giving their citizens a choice. And they have then a series of new questions and new problems to resolve. So in Malaysia, for practical purposes, we just don't have the supplies right now to introduce the, shall we say, the good problem, the luxury problem of choice. So I'll begin there. I'll then move on to say that when we get to that situation when Malaysia actually has supplies of multiple vaccines and we're giving citizens the right to choose, then it becomes a new situation requiring perhaps a few things. Firstly, a strong education campaign, meaning to educate people about the safety and the efficacy of all the vaccines. And frankly, the NPRA, the National Pharmaceutical Regulatory Agency of Malaysia, will not approve any vaccine if it's not safe or effective. So that's the education side. And then secondly, is the logistics and supply chain side, because if you want to give people the choice, do you want to give them the choice when they register on MySejahtera, or do you want to give them the choice just before they're about to be vaccinated? And that carries different implications on the supply chain, the planning, the databases, and so on. Now, I'm just running through the theoretical framework. I'm not taking a position as to choice is good or bad, because there are two sides to the debate about whether or not choice is good or bad. And we can definitely learn from other countries as well about how they manage choice. Thirdly and finally, if I can end with a thought about Sinovac, I think a lot of people are thinking about Sinovac and probably looking at the 50% clinical trial results. Well, that 50% clinical trial results is a stress test because that vaccine, that trial specifically, was done in Brazil, where they gave that vaccine to doctors and nurses and frontline health professionals who see COVID patients day in, day out. So if you get 50% protection when you see COVID patients day in, day out, that's probably, perhaps, I don't know, and I'll leave it to the average listener to decide, is that as good as a 90% protection in general population, which is where Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, that's where they get their trials from, general population of the average person who does not see COVID patients day in, day out. So seeing COVID patients day in, day out and get a 50% protection, you know, that's actually a pretty good number. Over to you.
So, speaking, we have very little time left, actually, just about a minute. Do you think collectively we're doing well in terms of ensuring vaccine equity? And what else could the government be doing in this area?
That's a difficult question to answer in 1 minute. So maybe
I'm sorry.
That's all right. So an observation and one suggestion. The observation would be we're off to a bit of a rocky start in terms of equity with the queue jumping, but we pull together with a series of rhetoric and promise actions. And that if implemented well, I think we can restore or rebuild public trust. So that's one observation. One specific thing that the government can do is to be transparent, because our tendency to say suppress information, well, maybe not suppress, but our tendency to not share information with the public during a period of vaccine confidence, where vaccine confidence is very crucial, may be counterproductive. So anything that we can do to increase transparency will be helpful.
Suiking, thank you so much for speaking with us. That was health policy specialist Dr. Kaw Suiking weighing in on the subject of queue jumping and a broader discussion really on vaccine equity. We'll be back with your messages. Keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.